Hello and welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We will keep you updated on the breaking news. Today, we're talking about college campuses and have they yet again become a battleground for freedom of speech. UC Berkeley, of course, has long been known as the birthplace of the free speech movement. It all began during the 1960s, during the Vietnam War protests. UC Berkeley is now seen by some as ground zero for attacks on free speech. For example, in February, right-wing commentator Milo Yiannopoulos was scheduled to speak at an event at UC Berkeley. It had to be canceled because what started as a peaceful demonstration shifted after some protesters, many of them not students at UC Berkeley, broke windows and destroyed property. And then in April, conservative figure Ann Coulter had to cancel her event after fears of threats of violence. But UC Berkeley isn't the only school facing criticism for allegedly limiting free speech. From Pierce Community College in Los Angeles to University of South Carolina, colleges across the country are now facing lawsuits that allege infringement of students' free speech rights. So what is the best way to protect free speech on campus? How do you strike that balance between protecting the civil liberties of all without limiting the civil rights of the speaker? Joining me today to untangle the free speech debate on college campuses, we have three guests. Henry Reichman is Professor Emeritus of History at California State University East Bay. He's the first Vice President of the American Association of University Professors, and he chairs the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. He joins us on the line from Washington, D.C., and he'll be discussing free speech rights. Thanks for being here, Professor Reichman.
Thank you.
Also joining me is Samantha Harris. She's Director of Policy Research at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. The acronym for that organization is FIRE. Harris conducts research on policies that affect speech at hundreds of colleges and universities, and she is the author of FIRE's annual report entitled Spotlight on Speech Codes. And she joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Welcome. Thank you for being here, Samantha.
Thank you for having me.
And finally joining us is Leisha Brooks. She leads the Southern Poverty Law Center's outreach efforts on key initiatives and social justice issues. The SPLC's outreach director is her other role. She frequently gives presentations around the country promoting tolerance and diversity, and she joins us on the line as well. Hello, Leisha. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Renee.
Let's start with sort of a round robin and go around and ask you, is the right to free speech absolute, and is it under threat on college campuses? Henry Reichman, let's start with you.
Well, I think it's very clear under the law that the right to free speech is not absolute, but it's pretty extensive in the public sphere, in public forums. And university campuses include public forums where speakers come and should have full rights, even if their views are abhorrent. And hence, our organization has, for many decades, supported the right of outside speakers invited by student groups or faculty groups to come on campus. That said, however, the university as a whole is not a public forum. Classrooms are not placed free marketplaces of ideas. They're places of instruction and inquiry. And so all ideas are not equivalent in the classroom. For instance, it is perfectly legitimate for someone to make a speech out on the campus advocating that the Earth is just 6,000 years old, but it would not be permissible for a geology professor to teach that in class.
Samantha, let's go to you next. Is it fair to characterize your organization, FIRE, as being libertarian when it comes to these issues? And if so, does that mean that you believe that the right to free speech on campuses and elsewhere is absolute?
Well, no. FIRE is entirely nonpartisan. You know, when it comes to the question of free speech, as Henry said, the right to free speech is not absolute. I mean, that's something that the law is very clear on. The First Amendment does provide very robust protections for free speech, but things like true threats, incitement to violence, defamation, and several other things are not actually protected under the First Amendment. So while FIRE does argue certainly that public schools, but that also a lot of private schools should give students and faculty on campus free speech rights coextensive with what the First Amendment offers. The First Amendment itself is not absolute.
And Leisha Brooks of the Southern Poverty Law Center, can you weigh in on the question of whether the right to free speech is absolute on college campuses?
As the previous speakers have shared, no, it is not an absolute right. There are specific legal limits. Specific to an educational environment, the First Amendment does not protect, for instance, speech or expressive conduct when it targets a protected class, right? And there are other limitations. But as we continue the debate over First Amendment rights on college campuses, SPLC is particularly interested or concerned about the significant surge in hate activity on college campuses over the last 2 years.
And we'll certainly be getting into the definition of hate speech, what it is and who determines that. But I want to kind of start out a bit about what are the concerns about how the entire free speech debate is being handled and how it's unfolding on college and university campuses. Henry Reichman, as a professor, an active professor at Cal State East Bay, can you just talk about just how the whole discussion about free speech on campuses is unfolding?
Well, I think it's an important discussion. I'm glad we're having it. But I think there's been a tendency to focus on certain, very controversial cases like the Yiannopoulos case or like Ann Coulter, which I think people like them are really as much looking for publicity as much as they are trying to persuade everybody. And I think that what ends up happening is those kinds of battles tend to overshadow, I think, issues that are far more difficult and far more important. For instance, right now, large numbers of faculty and even some students are being subject to online targeted harassment when they speak out on Twitter or when they say something in a classroom that goes viral on some site. I find that a far more threatening element than the occasional ill-conceived and sometimes downright stupid demonstrations silencing a speaker, yet it gets far less publicity. There are many other challenges as well to free speech and academic freedom on campus. I could go on for hours. I'm worried that the conversation has become somewhat distorted as if the biggest problem was the right of people like Yiannopoulos and Coulter to speak rather than some deeper-seated and perhaps more difficult-to-resolve issues that we face on the campuses.
And Samantha Harris, there was a recent New York Times article indicating that students across the country are taking their universities to court for allegedly violating their free speech rights. And your organization, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, is apparently behind a number of those lawsuits. In your view, how are higher learning institutions perhaps violating free speech rights?
Well, they're violating free speech rights in a number of ways. I mean, one of the primary issues that FIRE deals with is what we call speech codes, which are written policies prohibiting speech that would, elsewhere would be protected by the First Amendment. And in the case of public universities, hence the lawsuits, actually is protected by the First Amendment. So I think that, through speech codes, universities are clearly prohibiting free speech. But I also think that there's something deeper going on a lot of campuses where we see a certain amount of hostility, and I think more, I've been at FIRE for 12 years, and this is something that I've seen grow in the time that I'm there, sort of a hostility towards free speech from students themselves. And I think that oftentimes universities, whether it's out of fear of sort of upsetting students now that universities are kind of more corporatized and we have more of a consumer model for students, or whether it's because of ideological agreement, they're afraid to defend the right to free speech in the face of student demands for censorship, whether or not they have written policies prohibiting free speech. And that's something that's of very deep concern to FIRE as well.
And Leisha Brooks of the SPLC, To what extent do you feel that the whole free speech argument, given that it had its roots in the left, so to speak, that the whole argument now has been turned on its head, and that people who have more right-leaning views are claiming, look, our speech is being, it's being violated, and should so-called hate speech in all its forms be protected on college campuses?
Well, let's be clear. Hate speech is protected speech, and I think it's unfortunate that some universities have really played into the hands of some white nationalist speakers who seek to increase their profile and publicity on college campuses, as Professor Reichman mentioned. I think that they have now taken this free speech argument because universities have disinvited them or canceled events, and that's extremely unfortunate. The Southern Poverty Law Center, of course, protects their or defends their right to speak on college campuses. Administrators need to do more to protect the students on campus and those that come on campus when these controversial speakers are there. We are not asking colleges to cancel or in any way trying to censor speech, but it is very important because there is an element of very real danger that takes place. It happened at UC Berkeley. Fortunately, no one was hurt. Someone was shot at Seattle University. I think that we're also leaving a big part out of the conversation in that there's another group you mentioned at the top, that it was primarily not students who caused the violence at UC Berkeley. In fact, it's another group of folks identifying themselves as anti-fascist or Antifa groups who are determined to follow these controversial speakers and engage in violence with them. So something needs to be done in advance, and that's really on the college administrators to ensure that the free speech rights of the listener, the speaker, and the protesters are protected.
And Samantha, one of the issues that your group, FIRE, litigates are campus free speech codes regarding who can say what. And many universities and colleges adopted codes like that back in the 80s. The idea, of course, at that time was to protect minority students from racial intolerance. So what speech codes does FIRE take issue with? Some of the codes are actually being challenged by your organization in lawsuits in court, yes?
Yes. Now, you know, the lawsuits you're referring to largely relate to what we call free speech zone policies, and those are policies that quarantine students' expressive rights to one or more sort of small areas of campus. Schools tend to be very afraid of disorder, you know, and as we've seen, disorder can happen, disorderly protests, but they pass regulations that are far too broad to deal with these things. So instead of just saying, okay, if a protest becomes disorderly or interferes with classes in session, you know, we can take disciplinary action after the fact, what they'll do is that they'll limit speech to very small areas of campus before the fact. And generally speaking, that's not constitutional. Now, when it comes to the harassment codes, you know, that you mentioned that were passed largely beginning in the 80s, actual harassment is one of the categories of speech that's not protected by the First Amendment. But it has a very specific legal definition, and the problem is that a lot of universities have broad harassment policies that target not just actual harassment, but any kind of hateful or offensive speech, which, as Leisha mentioned, a lot of which is constitutionally protected. So those policies, in trying to do that, often go too far.
But I think the idea is that some of those phrases seem mushy and don't have enough of a legal definition to actually help campuses understand what should be prevented and avoided and denied and what's allowable. So, Professor Reichman, as a person who works on campus regularly, what are your thoughts about who gets to say, and what are your thoughts about the use of so-called free speech zones?
Well, the AUP has opposed these free speech zones. I mean, obviously, there are time, place, and manner limitations on speech. You can't hold a rally in a classroom while a class is going on, for instance. But, you know, we've generally opposed free speech zones. We've generally been highly critical of free speech codes. Harassment is harassment. It needs to be addressed. I think the legal definitions are fairly clear. But I think it also, those definitions mean we simply have to tolerate on the campuses the fact that, you know, we have diverse student bodies with diverse experiences and views, and there are students who are going to insult other students in ways that are sometimes even unintentional. The real question is, how do we address that with policies and practices to educate? I mean, that's the whole purpose of the university, is to educate and not to punish. In that light, I mean, I want to say two things. One is that I think overall, American colleges and universities, for all their obvious flaws and some not so obvious, are still, I think, the institution in American society where the diversity of views and the ability to question, inquire, and argue and debate is most protected and most vigorous compared to almost any other institution in American society. The second point I want to make is to pick up on something Samantha said, which is about university administrators seeking to make students comfortable. I think this is really a problem. We've moved toward this corporate model of the university where the student is no longer just a student but a customer to be pleased. You know, the customer is always right. And I heard one wonderful story of a university, I believe it was Brown, where students were holding a demonstration against something, and the administrator comes down and the question she asks is, what can I do to make you more comfortable? And the students looked at her and said, we don't want to be more comfortable. We're making a political point. We're demonstrating. And the administrator could not understand that this demonstrator could not perceive it as anything other than some kind of expression of a discomfort or a dissatisfaction, rather than part of the kind of vigorous debate and discussion that should be characteristic of campuses at all times.
It's the kind of thing that people talk about at coffee shops and that they have on campuses across the country, and we want to invite our listeners to call in and weigh in. The number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Leisha Brooks, how does hate speech differ from, say, a hate crime, and when do those things cross over? How do you distinguish between hateful intent and hateful effect?
First of all, I mean, a crime has to have been committed in order for it to be labeled a hate crime. And then it must be proved that the primary motivation for the crime was hate or bias. So that's something that has to be looked at more carefully. Hate speech is just speech that someone finds offensive, hateful, biased, or bigoted speech or language. It's not at all a crime to engage in that type of speech. If I could go back to something that Professor Reichman said, and also Samantha, I completely agree that something needs to be done with respect to how colleges handle controversial speakers coming on campus. I do, though, take issue with painting students with a broad brush around kind of their, and to pick up the language of the alt-right, characterizing students as snowflakes that they can't. Possibly handle, you know, vigorous debate, and they're shying away from it, and administrators are trying to protect them from that. I don't think that's the case at all either. I think that oftentimes administrators are trying to have it both ways, that as they make strides to create safe and inclusive campuses, because as universities change demographically, things do need to be done in order to ensure that all students feel safe and included on those campuses. So I don't want to minimize that at all. I think what we've heard from students also is that that it's not kind of a level intellectual debate when students are forced to be in a position to defend their humanity. So I think that we can have some distinguishment on those points. It's our hope through we have a college program called SPLC on campus, and we're trying to really encourage administrators to certainly host these controversial speakers, simply come out with strong unapologetic statements about who and what they are, what it is that they're talking about. I think that oftentimes if students felt that someone was saying the truth about some of these speakers, rather than to kind of elevate their talking points to to, you know, some place of, you know, academic expertise, students might feel better supported in engaging them in a vigorous debate kind of on the scene. But, you know, no one ever makes those points. And so students who are already familiar with defending themselves and their own humanity day to day are then asked to, you know, face off with white nationalists or white supremacist speakers. And I'm not saying that all of them are that. I'm just saying that I just wanted to make the point.
So should hate speech be protected as a form of free speech?
It is. It should
yes.
be. It should be.
Okay. And who gets to decide just what hate speech is? Who's the arbiter? I think that's one of the big questions. And we have a caller who wants to weigh in on the history of the idea of free speech. David in San Francisco. Thanks for being here.
Oh, yeah. Morning. I ran into a book that was very popular in the in World War II. It was called Undercover, by a guy named John Roy Carlson, and in it he describes the Bund movement. Hitler, knowing he was going to attack various nations, sent in propaganda teams to break apart their social harmony, and then while they were all in discord, the attacks would come. So when you start looking at the specifics, the book lays out that the Bund in America, they had little cells of six people who might be in Wall Street. They might be in a church knitting circle. They might be in auto workers. They might be in shopkeeper girls. But these Bunds were intended to break apart the social harmony. And I'm just wondering if, first of all, if your guests are familiar with the Bund movement, and then whether or not I think one of your guests mentioned that it seemed like the people that were tracking down Yiannopoulos, were they in concert with each other to do that? Were they intending to kind of profiteer off of each other's breaking apart of the social harmony?
Professor Reichman, maybe you can weigh in on that. Have you heard of the Bund movement?
Yes, I have. Okay. I'm an historian of modern Europe by trade, so to speak. I mean, I think, yes, there were, you know, the whole question of fifth columns, et cetera, has always been a question in history, and how does a society protect itself? But I think that kind of thing comes up more now because we are living in very highly polarized political times. It is very clear that, especially since the election of President Trump, that the political situation in this country is not what some of us used to experience as so-called normal. And as a result, we're getting a certain kind of polarization, groups on the far right and the far left, sometimes advocating violence, and actually reminiscent less of the Nazi period than of the pre-Nazi period, beginning, as we've seen even in Berkeley, you know, street fighting against each other. Hope so far not anything close to the level that Weimar Germany experienced. And I think that poses challenges to free expression. And clearly, for a university, how to deal with that, especially one in an urban area, one like Berkeley, where you have to take into account not only the campus's own atmosphere, but the atmosphere of the surrounding community and the different groups that are organized there, can pose a real challenge. I don't envy people having to manage that, but I do think it's manageable. I do want to, however, return to something Leisha said before, because I very much agree about the students. My feeling has been the student protesters have been very unfairly tagged. Yes, they make some mistakes. There are extremists in their groups, but first of all, they're students. They're supposed to be learning, and we're supposed to be teaching them. And the real question is what do we model? What do we teach? Or do we just simply criticize, put down, or lecture? And I think there's a lot that can be done to help students learn. I mean, one example, Charles Murray, of course, is famously shouted down and even almost physically assaulted.
That was on the Middlebury campus. Yeah, we're going to talk about that. That was a very interesting situation.
Well, at Middlebury, I mean, if you look at part of the blame must go to there were outside agitators there, so to speak, as well. But part of the blame must go to the administration, which was very ham-fisted in their handling of it. He was invited by a student group, but the political science department decided to co-sponsor it, and the president decided to introduce Murray. Well, this, to the students, was a message of endorsement by the administration. A few weeks later, he spoke at Columbia University, where a large number of faculty members, including in the law school, issued a major statement that was sent around the campus explaining that, yes, we support Charles Murray's right to speak. Here's why we think what he has said is wrong. And then went through a whole thing about Murray and his academic credibility. Mm. Guess what? No problem there. Murray spoke. And, you know, so I think a lot of this has to do with how do we respond to students' legitimate concerns in ways that we can teach them and we can learn from them, too.
And there are lots of examples, unfortunately, now of just how campuses may be handling or mishandling this issue. We're talking today on your call with Vice President of the American Association of University Professors and Chair of the Committee on Academic Freedom, Professor Henry Reichman, and Director of Policy Research at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, that's Samantha Harris, and the Director of Outreach at the Southern Poverty Law Center, Leisha Brooks. We invite your call. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This is KLW in San Francisco. We have an update from the KLW newsroom. At least two people have been killed in a shooting at the UPS building in San Francisco's Potrero Hill neighborhood, according to multiple sources. Several others were injured. There's a massive police response. The area has been locked down around 17th and Vermont, and people in the neighborhood are being instructed to shelter in place. This is an active situation. More details to come as they emerge. And now back to your call.
For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is your call. We're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. There you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. If you have a show idea, we'd love to hear from you. Drop us a line, please. Feedback at yourcallradio.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. Coming up tomorrow, we'll follow up on a very lively conversation that we had about regulating the ride-hailing industry. We'll have a discussion about the current regulatory landscape and how our cities trying to influence how car services operate in their cities and how constituents can have their concerns voiced. Today, what's the right way to do free speech on campus? What about safe zones? What about hate speech? Who gets to decide what hate speech is, public safety issues, free speech zones, First Amendment. It's just not easy to write a campus speech code in the year 2017, but if colleges don't get this right, they do risk being sued or perhaps even having legislatures create the rules for them. So how do you defend free speech but also protect faculty and students from violence and harassment? We hope you'll join the conversation. The number is 866-798-8255. Let's go to Vahid. He's at Cal State East Bay himself. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Hi to everybody, and especially to my colleague, Henry Reichman. I have a question about the recent trend on campuses to institute trigger warnings in the classroom, where professors have to kind of forewarn students that they're going to talk about certain things that may be uncomfortable to some of the students in the classroom. How does that bump up against free speech, especially in the classroom? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Professor Reichman?
Yeah, well, we actually, the AUP's Committee A, issued a statement on trigger warnings a couple of years ago, and if I can summarize our position briefly, is that we believe that that certainly the movement that was developing for mandatory trigger warnings is, as we see it, a violation of academic freedom. That it is it's the role of the professor in the class to decide what the curriculum is and to decide how it's presented. That the notion that somehow students are overly sensitive and need to be warned any time that something might offend them is a fundamentally anti-intellectual position. And in fact, also one impossible to enforce, because who knows what will offend everybody. There's always something. That said, however, We have no objection to faculty members who they themselves believe that the best way to teach something is to inform students in advance that it may be difficult material. For instance, at the time we were putting together that policy, we had a law professor on our committee who taught the law of involving child pornography. Well, when he taught that class, there were cases that they studied in which people had to look at child pornography, and he felt obliged to warn them, to tell them that you're going to have to see child pornography in this class. And he asked us, he said, am I violating our policy? No, we said, as long as it's your choice to do that. And so that's basically been our position on trigger warnings, that they may be useful technique for a professor if the professor sees it useful, but should not be mandated by the institution.
Samantha Harris, do you have thoughts on Vahid's question?
Yes. Like Professor Reichman, I think that the trigger warning conversation is a little bit of a red herring in the debate over free speech, because we really, at least at FIRE, have not seen many instances where schools have attempted to implement mandatory trigger warnings. Usually it's something that is, as Professor Reichman said, voluntary and coming from the professor, him or herself. And from a free speech standpoint, there's no problem with this. I do think that to some extent there's a cultural question of whether the demands for trigger warnings reflect sort of the pathologization of discomfort that I think is leading elsewhere to demands for censorship of offensive speech and the like. But that's sort of a separate question from the free speech issue. From a free speech standpoint, we really have not seen a lot of issues arising from the question of trigger warnings, because, as I said, they're largely voluntary.
Just before the break, moving back to the direction of just what is hate speech and how it should be defined and who gets to choose and how do you deal with it, Professor Reichman, you mentioned Middlebury College. Just to bring listeners up to speed, one of the student groups at Middlebury College is called the American Enterprise Club, and earlier this year, the AIE invited Dr. Charles Murray to come and speak there. You might remember he's the author of The Bell Curve. It was written about 20-some years ago, and its argument is that intelligence is race and class-based, which is a very provocative position. He was shouted down. People turned their backs when he was trying to speak. A left-leaning professor had been invited there to debate him, but it was totally disrupted. They both had to leave, and the car that they were in was attacked. So it was put forward that when leftist protest right-wing speakers on campus, they deny that they're infringing upon free speech. That's the argument that was made. Free speech, they say, does not require the university to give a platform to people with offensive views. So, Leisha Brooks, I'll ask you, is that the argument? If you don't want violence, don't invite the Ann Coulters, don't invite the Yiannopouloses.
No, that's not the Southern Poverty Law Center's position at all. I completely agree with what Professor Reichman stated earlier. It was how the university handled it, and so I'll just underscore that point again, that controversial speakers, be they you know, academics and authors like Mr. Murray, and or you know, provocateurs like Milo Yiannopoulos, things need to be handled properly. And I think the example that the professor offered earlier speak to how easily that can be done. Students are completely reasonable. They, as my understanding, would like to engage in some conversation about the who's, what, and why prior to the speaker speaking. And, of course, I just think it's never a good idea for the university president to introduce a speaker that is that controversial.
Well, I'd also like to get your take, Leisha, on Dr. Kianga Yamada-Taylor, who's the assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton. She wrote the book From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She recently announced that she was canceling speaking engagements in Seattle and at UC San Diego. She said she received more than 50 threatening emails that came after a Fox News segment that featured Dr. Taylor, and she called Donald Trump, quote, a racist, sexist, megalomaniac, unquote, and That happened in a commencement speech. And ever since then, some have asked, where is the outrage for her? And they argue that she's received much less attention than, say, a Maya Yiannopoulos or an Ann Coulter. Your thoughts?
That's true. And again, referring back to what Professor said earlier around the bigger issues around free speech and censored speech on college campuses, we've long tracked the harassment of professors on college campuses and with respect to what the Southern Poverty Law Center does in terms of tracking hate and extremism. It's primarily around this, people from the hard right who are attacking professors who seem to be too progressive or speak out against the president. They're keeping lists, they're spreading information, misinformation about the professors, creating a very unsafe space for them, even on their own university campus.
We want to invite your calls. It's one of those hot button issues nowadays. If you spend your days on a campus, if you're a student, a professor, an administrator, if you're a member of the staff, what are your thoughts about free speech on your campus? What are your thoughts on how free speech is being discussed in the media? Do you have concerns about that? What are your thoughts on free speech codes on college campuses? And if you were part of the free speech movement in the 60s, is there anything that strikes you about the debate then versus now? And what do you think is the best way to protect freedom of speech, but also the safety of those who wish to exercise it? The number is 866-798-8255. Let's go to Eli in San Francisco. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, hi, thanks for having me on. I've just noticed a big hypocrisy as far as what hate speech is approved, especially in America. You know, you can, people get all riled up about defending, you know, Nazis' right to march and white supremacists' right to speak or march, but you can't, as far as I know, if you're an extremist Muslim or you've come from an extremist Muslim group, you're not allowed to speak. ISIS, Al-Qaeda representatives, they can't speak here, and I know the argument against that is they're a foreign combatant and they're at war with the United States. I would argue that the white supremacists are too. You had an attack in Portland the other day. You had the Dylann Roof attack. You've had white supremacist attack all over the United States. So I don't really see, you know, hate is hate, and if it's inciting violence and destabilizing the country, it should be seen as the same thing. So I just don't understand. It seems like there's a huge hypocrisy between what we allow. You know, the Nazis used to be the big bad guy, and you know, nobody wanted to talk about it, but their you know, their way of life and their speech is protected. But for people that are on a side that Americans don't agree with, or some Americans, they're not allowed to. And my other point is that, you know, 2 years ago, I'm a news hound, and I follow a lot of politics, and we were not talking about this. And I think that people don't want to talk about the fact that, you know, there's a white populist nationalist movement across the globe, Austria, Germany, France. There's a lot of movements out there, and we happen to have a white nationalist populist president. And it's not, you know, I'm not calling him a Nazi or a KKK or anything like that, but what he represents, that base gets really excited about. And that's why you have the Ann Coulters and the Yiannopoulos and everybody coming out of the woodwork, because everybody's excited about the movement in the United States and the movement towards, you know, basically white populist nationalism. And so there's those are the people that are in control right now, and whether people want to talk about it, that's what's going on. And so I really don't understand why there's really talk about having free speech for some and not free speech for others. It's either free speech for all or none.
Well, before you go, as a news hound, Eli, let me ask you, if you're a news hound, what are your thoughts about how media is even covering this issue?
You know, again, it depends on what station you listen to. You know, I've cut out most major media outlets because, you know, you get one side that says all the same thing, like Fox News, and you get another side that says all the same thing, like MSNBC. I tend to go with, you know, BBC and NPR, and people can say what they want about those news sources. But, you know, I think people get what they want to get. You know, I think that, like the caller brought up earlier about the, you know, the professors on the left have been crucified by the right forever. And it's so hilarious to me that people, it's a huge thing about the riots in Berkeley and, oh no, where's my free speech? It's just stupid to me, because the people on the left, you have the guy in Silicon Valley earlier this year who was teaching a class and taught about Trump and compared him to Hitler, and he was fired. You know what I mean? So it's like it goes both ways, and the fact that now the left is being seen as the violent left, and you know, I saw a really inflammatory article by Newt Gingrich the other day, which was almost inciting civil war, where he was saying it's time for Trump supporters to get up and fight for the president, or we're going to lose the country. You know, his speech was so inflammatory, it spooked me.
Okay.
Because I think that there's a lot of people in that corner who are really, you know, using things like happened in Berkeley to drive a deeper wedge and to try to, you know, as crazy as it sounds, support something like a civil war in this country.
Thanks a lot, Eli. Samantha Harris, Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Your thoughts?
I'm on the line to respond to this, but I would be curious to know what incident he's actually thinking of where someone with, you know, the equivalent of white supremacist views was denied the opportunity to speak. I mean, from a First Amendment standpoint, those kinds of speech are equally protected, and we do see, people expressing hateful views from across the political spectrum. So, I mean, you know, the caller's absolutely right that free speech for all means free speech for all. But at the same time, that is, you know, legally speaking, what we do have in this country.
May I chime in? Because I think a point that Eli was trying to make that I think is very important is that there has been a disproportionate attention in much of the media, etc., with the concern that somehow universities, which are characterized as being ultra-liberal or left, with the faculty being ultra-liberal or left, which is only partly true. You go to business schools and economics departments, it's quite different. But as suppressing the views of the right, and when in fact there's much less attention paid to the threats that are widespread against professors who might be and students who might be characterized as on the left. And I want to make two points about that. One is, I think that's true, but that's precisely an argument why the left-wing students are foolish to try to deny the free speech rights of people like even Yiannopoulos and Coulter, because once you institutionalize that, it's far more likely to be used against them than it is against more established figures. And the second point is, I think we're going back to the case of Professor Taylor from Princeton, and I think you were right to say that there's far more attention to Yiannopoulos and Coulter than there was to her as an outside speaker who was put down. I will say, however, that there was some attention, including a very good article by Samantha Harris on Vox.com, pointing out precisely the fact that people who defend Yiannopoulos and Coulter need to defend Taylor as well. But this is widespread. There's another case, for instance, Professor Denise Allen, African-American woman professor at Harvard, who was placed on something called the Professor Watch List. Something the AUP has spoken out again, which is a kind of blacklist of allegedly leftist professors, and as a result received horrendous hate mail, voicemail threats, etc., really awful stuff. And in fact, she actually wrote an op-ed defending Charles Murray's right to speak.
Alicia Brooks, Southern Poverty Law Center, has no doubt weighed in on this sort of thing. What are your observations?
I completely agree with what has been said. I think the point that I take from Eli is that really and the media's attention and really public opinion seems to, the folks seem to weigh in on the free speech issue more when it relates to these kind of, you know, larger than life figures on the right. They don't seem to weigh in. Say, for instance, I don't even have to go to kind of Muslim jihadist extremists. I could say, you know, the whole conversation about Colin Kaepernick and what he did, you know, in an expression of his free speech. Some of it gets, you know, praised and some of it, you know, gets vilified. But it does seem that the media and the public opinion is more squarely focused on protecting the rights of people on the far right. I would also point out that, and I agree, that universities are largely painted as these kind of liberal bastions, you know, there are no conservatives on campus, which is completely false. I would say, though, that we pay very little attention to the fact that if you look at some more private conservative institutions, they are never inviting kind of people on the left, you know. So I think I agree that in order to, I'm a big supporter of liberal arts education, and we need to present all views. Again, it's just how it's done and what you know how we talk about it in the aftermath.
And whose ox is being gored.
That's right. That's mm-hmm. right.
Let's go to Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Welcome.
Good morning. I just wanted to know the speaker's thoughts on the Stokey case, where I'd argued with a friend of mine who said that they should have been disallowed marching, and the Supreme Court actually heard the case and declared that they were pro-Nazi, that they had a right to express those views as egregious as they were. And as it turned out, the march itself was basically a tempest in a teapot. It was no big deal. Nobody got hurt. There was nothing at all like the Yiannopoulos situation in Berkeley or any of the others. And I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on the Supreme Court ruling in the Stokey case.
Professor Eichmann, Skokie, Illinois, I remember it. How does that apply to what's happening in the free speech debate in 2017?
Well, I think that this Stokey case is very clear that political speech, even political speech from far extremes that most people find deeply, deeply offensive, is protected speech. Nazis, communists, whatever, you know, have the right to organize and demonstrate. I like what the caller said about the fact that when push came to shove and the demonstration actually happened, it was a tempest in a teapot. And indeed, I think that's a lesson for a lot of people. When somebody who comes to campus, like a Milo Yiannopoulos, who unlike even a Charles Murray or some or Professor Taylor, and that has no real academic or intellectual agenda, is just out there to be a provocateur. Don't let him provoke you.
Well, the idea is, in fact, in many cases, to test the limits of the law, the limits of the culture, and there's nothing wrong with pushing boundaries. Samantha, that's my thinking in terms of how you go about finding out what the limits of free speech are. Samantha Harris?
Yes, I mean, I think, you know, going back to what the caller said about the tempest in the teapot, I think what it really illustrates, too, is the importance of exposing bad ideas to ridicule and to scorn, which is an important aspect of the right to free speech. I mean, if bad ideas are sort of pushed underground and allowed to fester, they're oftentimes given a lot more sort of gravitas that way than if, you know, there end up being two Nazis marching through town and lots of people pointing and laughing at them, or, you know, something similar happening with, say, members of the Westboro Baptist Church, where the protests are routinely larger than the church's demonstration itself. So I think that you know, she really illustrated the point of the importance of exposing bad ideas to sunlight and letting them be rebuked and rebutted as opposed to driving them underground.
I'm also interested in, Leisha, if your organization, the Southern Poverty Law Center, given the current climate around the free speech on campus debates, do you have any kind of special focus that you're targeting in terms of addressing this issue?
Well, as Samantha just said, we are trying to bring everything to light. It's a little bit different now, though, in this present political reality. In addition to the polarization, you know, kind of what Eli referred to, which we call hate in the mainstream, what used to be kind of on the margins is now coming into mainstream culture and discourse, and some would say in the White House, the Southern Poverty Law Center would say that there are white nationalists that are you know, have senior level positions at the White House. So it's a much different proposition. The same thing is true, but it's not as simple as just kind of shining a light on this speech or these ideologies, because it's much more challenging to combat it. And so that's why it's so important for us to kind of always call people out for what they are and what their ideology represents, and shining a brighter light on what is. We continue to just, you know, publish information about who's affiliated with hate groups, and how they might be connected to elected officials, what we can do to kind of continue to push back against hate and extremism in the mainstream.
Well, we started out with a sort of a round robin, and I'd like to wind up with the same thing, with a question. And I'd like for each of you to just respond, starting with you, Professor Reichman. Just how do you strike a balance between protecting the civil rights of everyone without limiting the civil liberties of a potentially provocative speaker? Professor Reichman?
Well, ultimately, I think you have to take the position that, speech is speech, unless it is, you know, specifically harassing speech, i.e. a threat to somebody directly. That you have to, let me back up. Somebody, a professor at Berkeley, wrote something a while back on a blog where he said that the university, first of all, should be a safe space for ideas and then a safe space for scholars. In other words, scholars being not just the scholars, the faculty, but anybody studying there, including the students. We have to simultaneously guarantee that there is safety for all ideas to be expressed. But in order for that to happen, we have to make sure that everybody in the, on the university campus feels safe. Not safe from being insulted or being offended, because there is no right to not be offended, but safe to know that you are a part of the community, your presence is valued, your safety is a matter of institutional concern as much as of anyone else on that campus.
Okay, with a little bit of time left, I want to make sure Samantha Harris, Director of Outreach at the... with Samantha Harris. So can you weigh in for us briefly? We've got about 30 seconds.
Yes. I mean, the remedy to speech you disagree with is more speech. And allowing speech that you don't like doesn't mean you have to agree with it. In fact, you know, people should vigorously challenge speech they disagree with, but they should do so in a constructive way that, you know, unlike these shoutdowns that we've seen, doesn't actually infringe on the right to free speech of the speaker, him or herself.
All right. Leisha Brooks, Southern Poverty Law Center. Your last thoughts with 30 seconds.
No one has a right to actively harm others with their speech or with their actions. So we'll leave it there.
Okay. We've been speaking with Vice President of the American Association of University Professors, Henry Reichman, Director of Policy Research at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or FIRE, that's Samantha Harris, and the Director of Outreach at the Southern Poverty Law Center, Leisha Brooks. Thank all three of you for joining us. Thank you for your calls today and for tuning in. And thanks for your emails and as well. It's an interesting subject. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. Coming up tomorrow, following up on our conversation about regulating the ride-sharing industry, a discussion about the current regulatory landscape. Our show today was produced by Laura Flynn and Sana Saleem. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. Kevin Vance is the studio engineer. Email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks so much again for listening. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.